Every man or woman who attempts to live for God is eventually going to run into a wall. He will encounter a barrier or some enemy who will try to stop him. And I would say that this is not the exception, but the rule. If life were always within the scope of our management, we would never manage to find our way to God. Life is often beyond us, so that we're driven to the one who is bigger than us. Even if your path be through the valley of the shadow of death. I've entitled the message today, In the Shadow of Death. Author Elie Wiesel writes of a time in his life when he was involved in an auto accident and damaged his entire left side of his body. It was shattered in the accident. After 10 hours of reconstructive surgery and months of recovery, his friends were constantly trying to console him with the same thought, you're lucky. It could have been worse. You could have lost your sight, your legs, or your mind. While Wiesel is listening to those words, it reminded him of a story in his mind where he heard about a man who lost a great deal, a litany of woes, including losing his job, his house, his money, his fiancée. And his friend kept telling him, it could have been worse. It could have been worse. Finally, the man screamed out, how could it have been worse? And his friend said, it could have happened to me. That's what makes our subject today so intriguing, I believe. We finally get to look at the suffering of David, and because it's somebody else, we can learn lessons from it that we might miss if we were in it ourselves. And it's neat, too, because the way the scripture is written, we get to read it from the third person, omniscient perspective, all you literary buffs out there. It means we get to look at the story from the eyes of God and what He's trying to accomplish in a person's life through difficult circumstances. Already, Saul has threatened David's life. David dodged the spear, as I mentioned a moment ago, and fled the palace in safety. And Saul, though, is continuing his pursuit. He won't let up. Burning with jealousy and hatred toward David, he is determined for David to meet an early demise. So today I want to sum up, and rather than look at just each of the episodes of what Saul is trying to do to undermine David and to kill him, I thought I'd just group them together, and I think some of the same lessons are in each of these episodes. So we're going to cover about two chapters today, from chapter 18, verse 17, through the end of chapter 19. And I want you to see through it all God's favor, even though David was in danger. So when the world casts a shadow of hate, and even if that be a shadow of death, we are to remember that God still has a hold of us with His love. And I want you to see that in two parts today. I've divided the message that way. We didn't talk about you didn't show them the picture of the guy with the, okay, it could have been worse. All right, let's go to the next screen. We want to give you the first point today. I want to talk to you about the schemes of man. If Disney was writing an evil villain into one of its classics, it could just write Saul. Saul would fit the part. He has a fiendish hatred for David, and he is trying to do anything possible to eliminate him. In fact, Saul worked so hard at this that aside from chasing the Philistines off of Israel's ground a couple times, he spends the rest of his kingship, all the years that he reigned, chasing David. That becomes the number one agenda of Saul's reign. So I want you to notice some of the schemes that Saul uses to try to eliminate David, his enemy, and get rid of him because he's jealous that he's rising in popularity, not only with man, but also with God. Saul's first thought was, I can use a marriage proposal. So the first scheme was marriage proposal. And in chapter 18, verse number 17, we read about that proposal to Merab, his older daughter. Let's go ahead and read the text. Chapter 18, verse 17, Saul said to David, behold, my elder daughter Merab, her will I give thee to wife. Only be thou valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul said, let not mine hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him. The scripture gives it that omniscient perspective. What was Saul really after? He wasn't concerned that Saul be part of his family, that David rather become his son-in-law. He was more interested in David going to battle to earn the right to be the king's son-in-law and some demise happening to David in battle. If he sent him out against a great number of evil or enemy forces, he would either die in battle or maybe something else would work to Saul's advantage. He would lose some battles and his popularity would fall and Saul would rise up again. You know, that's how it works, you know. It's not just that you just want your enemy to diminish in popularity. That's what Saul seems to be after. Well, the text goes on to say, and we won't read the whole section in chapter 18, but Saul gives Merib away. And someone comes along, one of Saul's nobles, and says, you know, your younger daughter, Michal, she really loves David. Saul thought, well, here's my chance. I'll make David really work for Michal. So he makes this bargaining. He has to come up with the bride price. A price was typical to pay for a bride. If I had to do that, I don't think I'd ever been married. It was hard enough to pay enough to get a ring on her finger. But they did pay some kind of a bride price to the future the father-in-law, the father of the bride. And this was probably in place so that if something happened to the husband, he was no longer able to provide for his wife, and she had to come back into the home of her dad and mom, they would have the means by which to take care of her. It was some kind of an insurance policy. But David was willing to overlook that, Saul was willing to overlook that in exchange for David going into battle against the Philistines. And the terms were, bring back 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Now, it was common in this day to use some kind of body part, thumbs, hands, as proof that you had really conquered your enemy. David not only met the quota, he doubled the quota, brought back 200, so the marriage took place. So, wasn't quite working the way Saul had planned. Again, he is foiled, and God delivered David despite the odds that were against him in the battle against his enemies. Saul wasn't done, though. He failed the first time, so his next thought was, let's work on a mandate from the king. I won't be the only one looking at him. I'll be asking Jonathan, my son, and the rest of the king's nobles to look for him. And this is the passage that Jim read earlier in the service. It's chapter 19, verse number 1. Let's look at that right now. If you have your Bible open, chapter 19, verse 1 says, Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants, that they should kill David. Well, you have more people looking, more people with their ear to the ground, better chance of getting your objective accomplished. And that's what Saul was hoping for. There's only one thing that was working against Saul. Look at verse number 2. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. Foiled his plans again. Jonathan is looking out for David, and he's more loyal to David than he is to his own father. Plan 2, failed. Plan 3, let's set out a manhunt. Or I'm sorry, a misguided spear. This now, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, but Saul, again, he's in the home, in his palace. That evil spirit that God sent to afflict Saul comes upon him. And David plays the harp as he has in the past. And Saul once again throws a spear at David. And David's just barely able to dodge the spear and get out of the palace again under threat of his life. In fact, verse number 10 of chapter 19 mentions that. If you look at chapter 19, verse 10, Saul sought to smite David to the wall with the javelin. But he slipped away out of Saul's presence, and he smote the javelin into the wall. David fled and escaped that night. Some have wondered how Saul, a great warrior, could have missed twice, earlier and now this time. But if you recall a couple of weeks ago when I talked about that, the javelin that he was using wasn't the kind that you throw. It was really the kind that you use, you carry in your hand, you thrust it into your enemy on the front lines of battle. So it was bigger and heavier and awkward to throw. Now, Saul was able to throw it because he was a mighty warrior, but he didn't have the accuracy. And God delivered David a third time from Saul's attempts on his life. Finally, when all else failed, he issued an all-out manhunt on David. And the first thing he did was stalk his house. Well, his wife, Michal, becomes aware of it, apparently ahead of David, and says, listen, Saul's got the house surrounded. When you go out in the morning, kaplooey, all right? Is that okay to use that word, kaplooey? That seems all right. So Michael says, if you don't get out tonight, verse 11, something bad's going to happen to you. So she lets him down over out a window. How many stories in the Bible you have someone escaping out a window? I don't know what it is about windows, but everybody's getting out the window. And so David got out of the window, down over the wall, and he escapes out of Saul's hand. In fact, Michael is so coy and so loyal to David that she takes a teraphim, a false god. Now, why they had one, I'm not sure, but some kind of a statue, all right? It would be tantamount to seeing these Buddhas, you know, that you see around. And she took, and it must have been somewhat life-size, because she's able to put that into the bed and take some goat's hair and put the goat hair on top of this thing. And when the soldiers actually go into the house because David won't come out, they think he's, and she says, well, he's in bed sleeping. He's sick. And they go in and look, and the soldiers go back and say, Saul, see, the guy's sick. What are we supposed to do? Saul says, you get back to that house. You pick that bed up and you bring him here and I'll thrust him through. So this time, goat's hair was probably the beast. The sheep and the goats in the Middle East have brown or black hair, not the white-haired or gray-haired goats that you're thinking about. So it's very conceivable that this would have been a good fake job. Boy, was Saul upset at his daughter. She barely escaped with her life by claiming that David threatened hers, which wasn't really true, but God again delivered David despite all of the schemes that were launched against him. Now in the next several chapters, we're going to read about Saul's pursuit all over the kingdom as David weaves in and out of forests and mountains and valleys and En-Gedi, trying to get away from Saul. He'll spend about 12 years on the run trying to stay away from a guy who's trying to murder him. Now I went through that quickly because we don't need an operating manual on how to kill somebody if you're trying to get rid of them. That isn't what this church is about, all right? We're not trying to teach you how to murder somebody. So I wanted you to think, though, I mean, why even talk about that? There's a couple things I'd like you to think about, two questions I have. And the first question is this, that would help bring this text a little bit to life for us. Number one, why does God allow us to walk in the shadow of death or under the cloud of hate? Because some of you have felt the same way. You felt hotly pursued, maybe by an employer or by a family member or an estranged spouse that just seemed to dominate you and you couldn't get away. Why does God let that happen? Now, I wouldn't presume to know all that God is up to, and it's really beyond the scope of this message to answer this question thoroughly, because this could be a whole message by itself, and this is just kind of an aside. We're kind of just reflecting. So what is God up to when people are after us, trying to get us, or trying to harm us? And I think God is up to things. And God, He is so much wiser than us. I'm learning this. It takes a while for it to sink in. We think, oh, this is the reason God let this happen to my son. This is the reason why God let the untimely death of, or this is the reason. Folks, God is so much bigger than one reason. Now, I'm thankful anytime He tells me, He gives me a little insight and says, this is the reason I did that. I'm grateful. But that is not the only reason. I mean, you think about this. Illustration, right? This isn't even in the message, so this is free. This isn't even on paper. All right. A thunderstorm blows into town. Great! It's just when your crops are planted, you need the water. Your seeds love it. They soak it up, and they begin to grow. But at the same time that God sent in that thunderstorm so that you can have water, it ends up careening some car off the roadway and it off the freeway, and it flips over, and somebody's in critical condition. God isn't just watering your plants, though He is. That's one reason, but that isn't the only reason He sent the thunderstorm. Now I want you to back out of a thunderstorm, and I want you to put that in any kind of suffering you go through your life. And yes, God is doing something in your life, but God is so big. There's probably 50 or 100 other things He's doing in other people's life through what happened to you at the same time. And all we can kind of think of, you know, this is our human nature. We just kind of lock into, oh, groan, I have to go through this. This is so hard. I'm not going to make it. And I don't even know why God's sending. God has so many reasons for doing things. We'll never get to the bottom of it. But believe me, He does have reasons. I want to give you just one reason here. That was the rabbit trail. Why am I only giving you one? For time. This isn't the message. There are other reasons. God's bigger than one reason. But one reason. that God lets us go through difficult times with people hounding us or hating us or trying to hurt us. He's trying to drive you to a place where you have no contingency, no plan B, no alternative, but to trust Him. The Bible says in Psalm 62 in verse number 8, "Trust in Him at all times, ye people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us." Trust in Him how many times? All the time. The schemes of men have a way of stripping us of our self-confidence. And when I use the word self-confidence, I'm using it in a negative light. I'm talking about the sinful attitude that says, I can handle life on my own. And God is letting the difficulty, the suffering, the persecution, the hatred, whatever you mask it, or whatever word you put on it, He's using it in your life to drive you to the point that you have nowhere else to go but to Him. Because Mama ain't going to be there, and Visa and MasterCard aren't going to get me out. I only have God. This is what God's doing to David. You put this, David strips him. God strips David of the security of the palace life. Strips him of his friend Jonathan. Then his wife Michael. He even strips him of his friend, we'll see in a minute, of Samuel. He's constantly stripping David of people and things that he's putting his confidence in, so he has to trust God and God alone to protect him. In 2004, Naomi and her husband, Bobby, followed a nurse down to the hall so they could meet the doctor. They knew something was wrong with their 8-year-old daughter, Carissa. This is a picture of them on the screen. They just didn't know what. Then the doctor delivered the dreadful news. Carissa had leukemia. They were doing their best to hang on to faith in those early days, but Naomi and her husband were still reeling with the news, as any of us in this room would be doing. Naomi writes, "The first month was the most difficult. Early on, Carissa suffered two complications that threatened to take her life. And humanly speaking, it seemed that everything that could go wrong was going wrong." Been there? "By removing every source of confidence," this is the quote, "that we could have outside of Himself, He reminded us that He was in control and that it would be by His power and for His glory that He would accomplish His will." So God is up to something good, even when you're under the cloud of hatred and people are pursuing you to harm you. I have another question. Because this isn't all about David's hatred, all right? What's God trying to do through this? God is active. Why is God allowing the suffering? At least one reason: to strip us of all our other hopes so we put all our trust and depend entirely on God. Number two, who wanted David dead? What's the answer? Well, you're partly right. Saul wanted David dead, but I want you to look back at chapter 19 and verse number 9 again. Are you there? God caused, let me find the verse here, "The evil spirit from the Lord was upon Saul as he sat in his house with his javelin in his hand, and David played with his hand." This is just before he threw the javelin a second time. What was it? It was an evil spirit. A couple weeks ago we talked about the evil spirit. Obviously something from the demonic side that God had allowed in order to inflict punishment on Saul because he would not obey the Spirit of the Lord. You see this poetic justice of the Lord throughout all the Bible. Saul would not obey the Spirit of the Lord, so God sent a spirit, an evil spirit, upon him to afflict him. So who wanted Saul dead? Saul did, but who else wanted David dead? I believe Satan wanted David dead. And it's an interesting thing as you trace the handiwork of God and you think about the scriptures and overview. You don't take this story and put it into the big framework of God. Who messed up God's creation? Satan messed up God's creation, and sin entered the world, and ever since the world's been afflicted with a curse. But who's been trying to fix things ever since the beginning? In fact, from the very beginning, right after Adam and Eve sinned, what did God promise? "I will raise up for you a seed," I heard it over here, "a seed that will crush the head of the serpent." Genesis chapter 3 and verse number 15. And so that serpent has been looking down through time to see that, find out where that seed is. Now, why is that significant with David? Huh? God promised first it'll be the seed of Abraham. Then from Abraham came Jacob and the 12 tribes of Israel. And then God said, I'll put my hand on Judah. And then from Judah, who's the descendant of Judah? It's the son of Jesse that we know as David. So now God keeps narrowing and the plan begins to be becoming clear now. The seed is Abraham's seed. Then it's David's seed. And who is the greater son of David? Jesus Christ. So if Satan, who is very keenly watching the happenings of mankind on planet Earth all the time, he doesn't know the whole plan of God the way that God does and has everything figured out, but he can start seeing the trail. And he can see the line of Messiah narrowing down. And it's his opportunity to interrupt the course of history and to wreck salvation for the human race. So who wanted David dead? Satan wanted him dead because it would foil the plan of the gospel. It would ruin salvation. What's the next verse there? Oh, yes. You are of your father, the devil. Lust of your father ye will do. He was a murderer from the beginning. Who wanted David dead? It was Satan. But I want to go to the next screen. Salvation. Bring me up a picture. The Bible teaches that Jesus Christ is the bridge, the only way to God. Anytime throughout history, Satan could have interrupted the plan of God and diverted it. Of course, God was always in control and nothing would frustrate the plan of God. And the gospel prevailed. But to this day, there really is only one bridge from any person in the planet becoming rightly related to God, and it is Jesus Christ. Acts 4:12 says, there is salvation and not in any other, for there is none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. God's plan could not be stopped. David lived, and so did his greater son, Jesus Christ. And so salvation was brought to the entire human race. Now, there are some sitting in this room who are not yet rightly related to God through Jesus Christ. Being rightly related to God isn't about going to church. It's not really about being a better person. It's not about having faith, because there are a lot of people that have faith but don't have Jesus. It is faith in something specific. It is faith in Jesus Christ. I believe on Jesus Christ and I am saved. Jesus is the only passport that's accepted into heaven. You don't cross the border unless you're holding his hand. So in the wake of everything we've said about Saul, understand that there is somebody working against you today. Somebody doesn't want you written into the plan of salvation. Somebody is working hard to keep you lost. Some of you come here and you hear the gospel week after week and you're not even interested. Some of you fall asleep while I'm talking about it. And you know why that is? There is a devil out there who has blinded the eyes of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel should shine unto them. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. And so they remain lost. Why do you get it and your friend at work won't? You've talked to him and you've invited him and you've given him tracts and he can't see it. There's somebody who doesn't want him written into the plan of salvation. And that's a devil who is working. He's a murderer from the beginning. And if he can't take your life on this planet, he certainly doesn't want you to enjoy God's life on the other side of it. All right. What are we talking about? When you're under the shadow of hatred and death, I want you to remember, God still got a hold of you with his love. We see this in the life of David. Point number two. This one better be shorter. Number two, I want you to consider the smile of God. You could look at all the negative things that are happening to David and get quite discouraged, but I'm encouraged because I see the handiwork of God working through all of that Saul's trying to accomplish, and he's bringing it about for good. In fact, God is favoring David. He's smiling on David, and Saul himself can see it. Chapter 18, verse 28. Look there. 1 Samuel 18, verse 28. Saul, that's hard to say. Saul, just feel like I'm saying the same thing almost. All right. And knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michael loved him, and Saul was yet the more afraid of David, and Saul became David's enemy continually. Humanly speaking, it looked bleak. Saul wouldn't quit. When he failed one way, he tried a different way. But God kept providing ways of escape for David. And how did it happen? It happened through the help of his friends. Jim, could you see if the air will circulate and push the buttons or something? I'm about ready to... Maybe I'm the only one. Is anyone else hot in here? It does not seem like things are working the way they should at this time of year. Did you hear anything kick on? There it goes. You hear that? That's a blessed noise at this time of year. If it gets any more hotter, the other half of the congregation is going to go to sleep, all right? So I've already lost one. All right, here we go. So I think God's smile can be seen throughout all of these episodes in David's life. And I want you to see that. We see it through the friends that God sends him. The first example I want to show you is chapter 19, verse number 3. This is right after Saul has issued the mandate for all of his servants to kill David. And Jonathan delights in David. Verse 3, "And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where thou art, and I will commune with my father of thee, and what I see, that will I tell thee. And Jonathan spake good of David unto his father." Don't you like this about friends? Friends talk you up. They talk well of you. They speak well of you. And Jonathan was doing that even before his father. And as a result, Saul's attitude toward David changed for a short time. There's another thing that friends do, and I'm going to refer here to Michal, chapter 19, verses 11 to 17. She's looking out for David and helps him get out. So that's the next one under friends. Friends talk you up and friends get you out of trouble. Michal smelled the trouble before David did and helped him get out. Verse 12 says, "Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped." You know, true friends really put themselves on the line to help you out of your trouble. So thankful for friends like that. Another thing that friends do, we see this in the example of Samuel. This is over in chapter 19, verse 18 and following. So David fled. This is after he fled out the window with Michal's help. He fled and escaped and came to Samuel to Ramah, and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and dwelt in Naioth. And it was told Saul, saying, "Behold, David is at Naioth in Ramah." So what? Another thing that friends do is they put you up in an emergency. Aren't you glad that people in the past have put you up when you needed a room or a place to stay? David's fleeing, probably from Gibeah, which was the headquarters where the palace would have been at that time, to Ramah, which is only 2 miles to the east, not far away, but he had to get out of town. He had to get out quick. And he gets to Samuel, and Samuel's running a school of the prophets there, often referred to in the Old Testament as sons of the prophets. You read that, sons of the prophets? Those are prophets in training. That's what the expression means. And he probably had some kind of a school or dormitory, and he just made a room and put David in there. I was in Myanmar a couple months ago, and their dormitory for the boys was just like one large room packed with bunks. And if another student comes, they just figure out another way to pack one more in there. You know how that works? That's probably what they did with David here. But he put David up in his emergency. Three different friends, three different needs, one result. David escaped. Aren't friends wonderful? I got to move on. I'm going to hit this quickly. Proverbs 27 verse 10 says, "Thine own friend, thy father's friend forsake not. Neither go into thy brother's house in the day of calamity, for better is a neighbor." And I believe that word is to be synonymous with friend, so I'm going to read the word friend there. "For better is a friend that is near than a brother far off." Friends, how valuable they are. They're often away. We think God ought to just write our name in the sky or put an arrow which town we're supposed to move to. And God doesn't normally do that. He just works through our friends and the counsel that he provides, and the circumstances we have to kind of push us where he wants us to go. And God was using a very subtle way through David's friends to provide protection. Finally, on top of the help of his friends, we see here the hand of God. I was debating whether to call this the hand of God or the humor of God. How many of you believe God has a sense of humor? This is a little funny. I haven't told you about this episode. So David goes to Samuel in Ramah, and he goes actually out to Naioth, which is probably an encampment on the edge of town or about where the dormitory would be if I've properly identified where David's hiding from Saul. And Saul gets wind that David's not far away, so he sends out a company of men, guards, to grab David and execute him. And they get pretty close to the town and they start prophesying. Now, this is probably some kind of an ecstatic utterance. They weren't really preachers. Probably the sense in they got caught up in a religious experience of some sort. So Saul's trying to send people to kill him and they're having a praise and worship service. Oh dear. All right, that group didn't work. I'll send another group. The second group will take care of it. Same result. They're having a praise and worship service. They never find David. Another group goes. Three groups of guards are sent. Again, they get close to the town. They start having a praise and worship service. They can't even get to David. This is a hoot, right? So Saul thinks, all right, I'm going to go. I can't believe these guys. Can't get any good help around town. Can't even pay guards to go get a guy. What's the big deal? I'm going to go down. So he gets down. He wanders around a little bit. Finally gets down. What is it? This is about verse 22 or so. And finally makes his way toward the town. And he starts prophesying. In fact, he takes off his outer garments. Not all of his clothing, but it does say he took off his clothes. Which means his outer garments. And he's lying down, praising and worshiping God. Now, this is a very interesting observation. Saul, friend or foe of God? Friend or foe? Well, we have to put him in the foe category because he isn't following the voice of the Lord in his life. He starts prophesying. He's having some kind of religious experience. Is that something that God would be pleased with or that would say that Saul was on good terms with God because he's having a religious experience? Just a little bit of a side. This isn't in the message. This is free, right? Just because you're having a religious experience or you're all caught up in God doesn't mean that God cares a hoot about what you're doing. Today, there's a lot that goes under the name Christianity and worship that's nothing more than an ecstatic religious experience. And I don't think God's impressed at all. I think he was doing what he was doing on the day when Saul was caught up. He's laughing. In fact, the scriptures say that God will laugh at the wicked. And I think that's what's happening here. So I think it's neat. Hate is trying to reach David, but God's still smiling. Men are trying to undermine God's servant, but God is protecting his servant. And God is that way. Surely God has a sense of humor. These murderers are turned into God's messengers. I'm so thankful for that because I believe in a God. When everybody is stacked against me, I believe in a God who surrounds me. Psalm 34, verse 7, the angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them. I don't have time to develop it. I don't believe it's an angel there. The word Lord is capitalized. I believe it's a reference to the Son of God, the angel of the Lord, God himself, is round about me to protect me. In fact, that's why David writes those words in Psalm 34. He writes these words, Psalm 118, verse 6. The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do unto me? Let's bring that up. What can man do unto me? And then it's David, the shepherd boy, who puts it all in perspective when he writes, what's true of him is true of us in Psalm 23, verse 4. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. When you fall under a shadow of hate, remember God still holds you in his love. I'm going to finish with a story about Philip Crosby. He was, in his book, March Till They Die, tells of a forced march of American and European soldiers during the Korean conflict, November 1950, northward into North Korean territory. They were taking the Americans and Europeans they had captured as prisoners of war. He says about the march, it was terrible. They were forced sometimes to go 20 miles a day on their feet, hungry, emaciated, and suffering in the heat. And the soldiers that couldn't keep up would start to fall back. And then they would hear shots ring out. And they would know what was going on. Philip Crosby and his friends, as they passed the GIs who were struggling to keep up, they'd pass him and slowly whisper so as not to be heard by the guards, "God is near us in this dark hour. His love is real. His mercy is real. His forgiveness is real. His reward is waiting for us." I selected that story for this reason. When it does seem dark, there are still glimpses of God's love. And maybe if you can reach out, you can hear just a whisper of it right now. And God would be saying the same thing to you in your dark hour. Remember, you can never slip out of the grip of God's love for you. David shows it. We can see it. Now may God help us live it. Shall we pray?